I'm glad to be a part of this weekend retreat here in Mackenzie. And I'd like to welcome all of the people here personally. You know, and it's really a privilege to be asked to be a retreat leader. Can you imagine somebody like me being asked to be a retreat leader? You might, I hope you feel the same way when I'm finished talking. Because I tell you, once you find out what I always led, it'd be a little bit different, you know. But, I'd like to think that God is using me as a channel. I like to think that you're being used as a channel for me, because I'm not just here for you. I'm here for me, because I need so much to take back with me, because this has been a real tough year for me. And I know God is good, because I made it. I made it through this year, and I'm talking birthday-wise. And I really didn't think that I was going to make it through. And so I know that there's a lesson in this process, and I need to find out what the lesson is. And I'm trying to be teachable today. I'm trying not to have all of the answers and not to assume that I know everything that there is to know about Alcoholics Anonymous, because I do not. When Marguerite asked me to do this retreat, and she said, well, you know, you have to get your own format together. And I mean, it's been going through my mind over and over and over. What am I going to say? What am I going to do? What are we going to talk about? You know, and I just went crazy. So my attitude was, fuck it. Whatever we do, it's going to be on a spur of the moment type deal, you know, and that's basically where I'm at, because my sobriety has always been based on the spur of the moment. And I guess I should go back and qualify myself for those of you who need to know or who have never heard me a little bit about myself. And I would like to keep it in a general way, but I know me. It won't be in a general way. I've never done anything in a general way. I've always gotten deep, and like to share with you what it's been like, what happened, and what it's like today for me. Sobriety is the most important thing in my life, and I realize that more this year than I've ever known since I've been sober. If you're anything like I am, you're sitting out there, except for those of you who've already asked me, you probably want to know how old I am, how long I've been sober, and do I really have a message for you? And I understand that, because, see, it took a lot of women to get my attention. You know what I mean? It was like, nah. You know, I got sober when I was 23 years old. I'm 36. I have not drank since I've been sober. I had a birthday this month. I turned 13 years sober on this program. I am a woman. And at least I was a few minutes ago when I went to the bathroom. I might be done changed by now. I have the tendency to do that sometimes. But when I first got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was one of those people that you just didn't think was going to make this program. I had lived 50 or 60 years in a short 10 years of my drinking and using. I didn't look anything like I look today. Absolutely nothing like what I look today. I've gotten pretty in sobriety. And I mean soft and feminine, and that was not me 13 years ago when I got to this program. And I know that we're not supposed to get emotional this quick, but see, Jane already done messed me up. But I think about what it was like for me when I got here. I was 23 years old and I couldn't walk. I had alcoholic paralysis. I couldn't control my bowels or my kidneys. I weighed about 85 pounds, maybe 90 pounds. You could see the skeleton in my face. You knew I was going to die. My eyes had sunken back into my head. My skin was literally darker than what I am. I had a lot of acne-like sores all over my face and in my skin, on my body. And that was from drinking so much wine. I'm also a drug addict, and I used a lot of drugs. I ended up shooting drugs on the program, everything. And I wasn't but 23 years old, and I was already dying. I got real mentally ill, real mentally sick. My actions was very, very sick. People were praying for me no matter where I went, left and right, because they just knew it was just a matter of time before I died. My family took insurance out on me just in case I died, they'd be able to bury me. And I was always kicking around with men and women who was abusing me. I come from a background or a lifestyle that by the time I was 15 years old, I was living out on my own. I had been on the streets since I was 13 years old, turning tricks. I come from a family that was alcoholically inclined. My mom was an alcoholic. There was 9 kids, and the majority of the kids had some type of problem. If not alcohol or drugs, they were into food, or they were just plain crazy. Just absolutely plain crazy. And my father, my understanding that he was an alcoholic, I don't know. He died when I was 15 years old. I was the only child born to him from my mom. I understand that I have a lot of brothers other places. I believe I'm his only daughter. 26 brothers somewhere. 26 of them somewhere. I don't know who they are, what they are. So I don't go to bed with black men that has green eyes. Just in case he's my brother. Since I don't know, you know. I've always steered clear of those green-eyed black men. I said, no, darling, she might be my brother. You know. My dad was a real intelligent man. He was a carpenter. He was gifted. He was talented. He built a lot of homes, and he built his own home. And my mom and dad was never together. I was like a one-night stand, and out came me, you know. Some other man died thinking I was his daughter, but I look just like my dad. I walk like him. I talk like him. I have his eyes, you know, I mean, I'm a spit image of my father. And there was a lot of feelings growing up for me. I knew early in life, when I was 5, 6, and 7 years old, that I needed a lot more love than normal kids. I don't know what it was, but see, and I couldn't get it from my mom. I got it from my dad because I was his only little girl. And so I was like his pride and joy, and that man just spoiled me. I mean, I really got spoiled when I was real little. I remember living with him at 7 and 8 years old, and they used to have the poker games at his house on the weekends, and there was always a bunch of men, you know, around, and they would always give me a quarter because I was always a good dancer. Give me a quarter or some money to dance for them, or to fix coffee for them and bring it to the poker table. And they would always had money, always had a pocket full of money, you know. I didn't know that was set precedent for my lifestyle, you know. I didn't know that any of that was taking place at that point. I didn't know that I loved being center of attention. Because I was. I mean, even as a little girl, it's like, that's Cash's daughter. She looks just like Cash, and you should see her dance. And And she's the cutest little thing in the world, and I always shook my butt. You know, I mean, I just, you know, black people got soul. You know, you may not understand, or you might not know because they know all the black people here, but I always danced from waist down, you know. And so that turned me on, see, and I didn't know that, you know, because I only knew that I was dancing. I was innocent as a child, but I wasn't innocent too long because about 7 or 8 years old, I knew what they liked. 7, 8 years old, it clicked in that I knew what they liked. And I would go and ask them, you want me to dance for you? You know, so I could get that money. You know, so I could get that money. And there was a lot of other feelings going on when I was real tiny. There was feelings of, on the flip side of being, hating my mom because my mom was an alcoholic and she stayed drunk a lot. And my mom cussed a lot, and there was a lot of drinking and cursing and fighting in our home, and there was a lot of abuse, and my family called it being whooped. And today I understand that I was being physically abused, because my mom would spank you. Her spankings was if she didn't see any blood, you had not been whooped, you know. And she would hit you in the head with poker irons and iron. Cords I remember getting whoopings and a week later being able to pull the scabs off of my body, you know, from being spanked. That was being spanked. And I remember as a child the first time that I realized that what was happening inwardly to me is I discovered another thing that was going to set precedent in my life for the rest of my life till up to now. And about 9 years old, I discovered my own body. I discovered some feelings that were abnormal to me. I remember getting involved with a little boy when I was 9 years old. You know, and the feelings of playing house and the feelings of what was going on when he kissed me, when he touched me, said president, because right then and right there I bonded at 9 years old. I knew what I wanted from little boys. And 10, 11, and 12, and 13 years old, I was sneaking out of my mom's bedroom windows to go down the alley to be with little boys at that young of an age. And I liked the feelings. I mean, I really didn't know what I was doing, you know, but I liked the feelings, and that's what my sobriety has been based on, is feelings. And thank God that my sobriety has been based on feelings and not intellectual. I'm not an intellectual giant, but I'm a feeling giant. It's the feelings that have kept me sober on this program when there were times that I didn't want to make it. There were times that I just totally gave up. I didn't want to stay sober on this program. But my feelings, the gut-level feelings that I have to JoJo, you know, you just don't want to die. But those feelings of being a little girl and being in the warmth and the comfort of another man's arms and feeling like a real human being was going to be a part of my illness. And I didn't know that. And by the time I was 13 years old, I had discovered that if I gave you what you want, you would give me what I want. That was love, attention, and money. And at 13 years old, it was easy for me to solicit. You know, I just didn't have a problem with that at all. Didn't come a problem until I went to jail. You know, you solicit the wrong people, like the police. You know, they don't like that shit. You know what I mean? By the time I was 13 years old, I had a bad reputation in my hometown. All the little boys knew that I was easy. And they would say to each other, you don't even have to ask her for none. She'll just give it to you, you know. So there were never a problem with me and boys, except that they didn't want to be seen with me. They didn't want to be, you know, no public affairs, darling. You know, we go down through the alley, you know. And I was one of those women that they would say, meet me in the alley, and I would be there, and they'd bring a couple of their friends, you know. And I never questioned why you brought your friends. I thought, well, if one's good, two or three is better. And that's the way I drank, and just the way I used, you know. And there were a lot of feelings that were beginning to set in, and they were going to be a part of my illness. They were going to be a part of my alcoholism, and they were there before I ever took my first drink. They were there before I ever got loaded, because I was making love. I don't know if I was making love. I want to retract that. I was screwing before I ever drank. And drinking just kind of put fuel on the fire, and it went whoop, you know, and my personality went, you know, I said, Jesus, you know. And I'm one of those people that believe alcoholism kept me from the insane asylum, because I was so crazy and so way out there at 15 and 16 years old that alcoholism kind of, because it would depress me, it would put me in a down state of mind, and I would be not as erratic or as crazy as I would be if I didn't have anything in my system. At 15 or 16 years old, I was prime suspect for Alcoholics Anonymous, and I didn't know a thing about it. I didn't know that there was such a thing that was even in existence. In my neighborhood, you didn't have anybody talking about Alcoholics Anonymous. You didn't have anybody coming in and said, you know what, you may have a drinking problem. Maybe there's something wrong with you. We didn't know that. All I knew is that if I was supposed to drink and I was an alcoholic, give me a beer. Give me some. I mean, people would say, you're an alcoholic, drink, girl. They didn't know that if you were an alcoholic, you were not supposed to drink. You know, I mean, where I come from, the alcoholics were drunks, and they knew that they drank, and that's all that they knew. They didn't know anything about recovery for alcoholics. When I admitted that I was an alcoholic, my family said, don't tell anybody. Don't tell nobody you're an alcoholic. That's disgracing us. Now, I had just gotten out of jail from a 502, didn't own a car, and didn't have no driver's license. I had been in jail on numerous occasions, from defrauding the innkeeper to soliciting the police. Okay? Concealed weapons, drugs, stealing, you name it, I've been to jail for it, you know. And, they didn't want nobody to know I was an alcoholic. It was okay that they knew I was a tramp. Okay. It was okay that they knew I slept with every Tom, Dick, and Harry and Mary. It was okay that I was a low life. And I use that word literally. You know, low life tramp. You know. Bottomless pit. I was in such a bottomless pit that it had a trap door. I couldn't get out. I couldn't open it. I couldn't get out. I resigned myself to drink till I die when I was 19 years old. And most people haven't even taken their first drink at that point. And at 19 years old, I had given up on this world and whatever it had to offer. And I decided, you know what? I'm not going to make it anyway. So I might as well drink till I die. At about 19 years old, I had already had a little fluke with a marriage, and it was over with real fast. It only lasted 4 months. I had I was one of those women that men took advantage of, and they ran trains on, And, you know, I wouldn't get up and tell nobody that these four or five people had ran trains on me because I was hoping they'd come back. You know, because I liked it. I liked the attention. Except that I always had VD. They didn't like it, you know. They kind of got pissed off every once in a while. I didn't understand that. Especially because if I was drunk, they took advantage of it, and I didn't offer it to them. They took it. So I always felt like they should have gotten it, you know. But I tell you, you know, there's a price to pay for everything in sobriety, you know. And the price I've had to pay is that even during my sobriety, when I go home on vacations and stuff, every once in a while I run into a couple of these fellows, you know. They never let me forget, you know. I used to tell them, well, sweetheart, darling, I'm able to tell them sober, you know. Honey, it was good, wasn't it? They said, yeah. I said, well, you deserved it. It's okay. I mean, you were able to go to the doctor. Thank God I don't have AIDS. You know? That really shocked them. Yeah. But, you know, trying to be... See, my childhood is not anything that I really... I was talking to a lady today to pick me up from the airport, and I was sharing with her, you know, I try to flip back into my childhood to try to find the happy times, the real good times. There wasn't too many, you know, that I can remember. Because I always had those feelings going on inside of me, you know, and at 19 years old, you know, lived a whole lifetime. And you're ready to die. You're ready to leave this world. And you're too chicken shit to kill yourself. So what you do is you find people who are abusive who's going to hopefully kill you. You know, and I was always running to men that I would provoke them to jump on me. And I would say, you don't love me if you don't hit me. You know? If you don't beat me, you don't love me. See, because I had been taught as a little girl, once again... My mom used to say it all the time when she was beating me. I wouldn't beat you if I didn't love you. You ever heard that? That really sets in mentally sometimes. Be careful what you say to your kids. And they say, you know, I love you. And that's the only time a woman would tell me she loved me. Or even when she was in a drunken stupor and she would say things like, well, you know, I love all my kids. I used to tell her, Mommy, you got 9 kids. I wasn't born with all those kids. I came out alone. I was the 7th child. You know? Tell me you love me. And she just couldn't do it. It wasn't, she couldn't do it. You know, my mom's kind of love was, if she cussed you out, she loved you. If my mom didn't like you, she didn't say nothing to you. I remember being 18 months sober on this program and going home for the first time. And my hair had grown. It was about as long as it is now, maybe a little bit longer. I had my teeth fixed. Somebody was saying, what pretty teeth you have. These are not mine, but I paid for them. I mean, they're mine because I paid for them, you know. My two front teeth, see, they got knocked out. And I remember... I didn't have my teeth, I'm trying to think, yeah, I had my teeth fixed at that point. And I went home, and I remember getting out the car, and my mom and my sister were standing in the screen door, and the screen door was halfway open. And my sister was peering over my mom's shoulder as I got out the car. I was 18 months sober. I was 25 years old. And my sister said, ooh, Mama, look at JoJo's hair, you know. And my mom said, look at my daughter. And I remember walking up on the porch, and I saw a gleam go into my mom's eyes that I never want to ever forget. And she looked at me, she said, bitch, you looking good. You're looking good. Now, that was my mom's I love you. Because when I went in the house and And we got comfortable and settled down. I slept with my mom for those 2 weeks I was home. Her old man set up and slept in a chair, and I was in the bed with my mom. And we talked to the wee hours of the night. And I remember the first day I was home, and I was laying down in her bed. I was tired, long trip. I had been flying all night. And she was talking to a cousin of ours, and she would say things like, "Dolly, you should see this bitch. You know, Dolly, this horse sure looks good, you know." But that's the way my mom talked. That's her. That was her personality. That was the way she verbalized love. She did not know how to say, "I love you, JoJo. And you've turned out to be real wonderful." She did not know how to do that. But I tell you, the time came that she told me that. But that was like what I experienced then. And I had always wanted that woman's love, you know. And there was those feelings going on of wanting to please her, of wanting to be the best daughter she had. And I wasn't. I wasn't, because my alcoholism and my drug addiction would not allow me to do that, you know. And that reputation that I'm talking about at 13 and 14 years old, at 13 and 14, 15, 16 years old, I was involved in gay relationships. And where I come from, it's a real teeny tiny town, and they frown on that shit where I come from. And they didn't call you lesbians or gays. They didn't call you that. They used one of the most harshest, and I think harsh, terms that you could be used. They called you a bull dagger. I don't know if any of you have heard the term, but some of us have. That's a harsh term, you know, but where I come from. So I was known, quote, quote, as a bull dagger in my little hometown, and that's another thing that's hard to live down, you know, because it wasn't fashionable to be gay. Wasn't fashionable at all. And so I had to live that down. And it was okay, because I was one of those women that I just kind of turned people off. And the only way I could do that was by drinking and using. And I went on, you know, skipping through life, getting painfully involved and areas of my life that I had no control over. Men and women were just... I was like a yo-yo. I was up and down, up and down. And there came a time I didn't have a choice of who I was going to be with or what I was going to do or what I was going to say. It was like... It was a privilege if you let me be with you that night. You know? And... I never looked neck up to see if it was male or female, because that wasn't important to me. It was the companionship, it was the friendship, it was the needing to be involved, the needing to be, and whatever it was that I needed at that point. And that's what I needed. And it was always provided for me, until there came a time that neither male or female wanted to be with me. They would say things like, "Honey, I don't know what you are or what's going on with you, but I know I don't have time to deal with it, you know, and so you deal with it, you know. Last thing I need in my life is an old drunken bitch, and that's what you are." And you know what, when you're 19, 20, and 21 years old, and you think, "My God," you know, and you take a real good survey of your life and you try to determine what you've done to contribute to life, and, you know, is there any legacy that you're going to leave? And I wasn't going to leave nothing. I mean, absolutely nothing. I had quit school in the eighth grade. I had not had a successful relationship. I didn't have any valuable skills. Turning tricks was not working, because I was too drunk to ask for the money. I mean, there was a lot of times I came to There was a lot of times I came to and all I had, and excuse my language, Jack, I hate you in here. Well, I love you anyway. All I had was a wet ass and no money. And it's real sad when you don't even know who's been there. They were gone. They had gotten what they wanted and gone. They were jazzed. I guess they thought, shit, I don't have to pay for this. And then they'd come back and ask for me. I thought I was being asked for because I was good. They were asking for me because they knew if they gave me a beer, they didn't have to spend no more money. They got them a little piece for what? How much was beer? $2? I come to and I be angry and hostile and mad at myself and I think, damn, again? Happening on a regular basis, I said, girl, you ought to be ashamed of yourself. Too bad you ain't depending on nobody for this food, because you'd be starving, I don't even know why I'm talking about this, but it sure feels good. Yeah, because I'm a real honest person, okay? And I find that my sobriety, I believe that the quality of sobriety is based on the depth of your honesty. You know what I'm saying? And I'm not saying that you need to go to the podium where there's a bunch of men or whatever in an open meeting and say all of the stuff that I'm saying. But I think it's real important if you work the fifth step, and that's the fifth step, we're admitted to God, to ourselves, and another human being, and I want you to listen to this one word, to the exact. That's it. The exact. You don't spruce it up. The exact nature of our work, no matter how in-depth it is, and you don't want to take it to nobody else. Somebody in this program needs to know all of you. Every little deep, dark secret. You may not want to let nobody else in AA know, and that's fine, but one person needs to know. Some people choose them people to be their sponsors. Some people choose it to be their clergyman. I personally don't think I can have a sponsor and the quality of my relationship with that sponsor if I can't have an in-depth relationship with her. I don't want her. If I can't tell her everything that I need to tell her, I don't need her. She is not my sponsor. And that's the way I feel. My sponsors knew when I was doing wrong in sobriety. They knew when I was doing right in sobriety. I had the kind of sponsor that didn't judge me, that didn't condemn me, and she said, JoJo, I'm here to support you, even if you make the wrong decision, because you got to pay that price. And I think the only thing that you know, the bottom line that you need to know, or you got to know, is that no matter what you do, it's a learning experience. You don't have to get drunk. You don't have to get loaded. You endure the pain, you grow, and you learn from it. We get sober and we think, my God, I'm sicker. You're right, you're sicker. How in the world are we going to get better and the quality of our sobriety is going to be good if we don't go through a healing process? That's part of my session, so I want to get into that. It's called my healing process. I'm trying to stick to my story. But you can see I just go off. My head goes boom, Anyway, the honesty that I've portrayed in this program has made me who I am. And I tell you, I'm grateful. I'm really grateful. Because I do walk in my own personal brand of dignity today. I do. And it's not based on anybody else's sobriety or the way they work the steps or anything like that, but it's based on my own personal experience, the integrity of the honesty that I portray, and I got to tell you, there are times when I don't want to be that honest. But I know that if I don't, I'm going to pay a price. You see? Because I was always afraid that if you found out what I was really about, you'd ask me to get out of Alcoholics Anonymous. that you didn't want me here? Then there came a time in my life I discovered that I knew that I didn't want to be anybody else in Alcoholics Anonymous but me. And that meant that I wasn't you, and I couldn't be like you, and I couldn't think like you. And if you had time enough in your own life, being an alcoholic and being sober, to find faults, defects, and character assassination with me, what kind of sobriety could you have? Would it be something that I wanted? And I said, no. No. I would have to stay sober for me. I would have to be me because I couldn't be anybody else than me. Whether this is the package. You know? Whatever I am, whatever I've learned to be, I learned it right here in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know? Every thank you, may I please excuse me. I learned right here in Alcoholics Anonymous because that's not my language. Get the fuck out of my way. Bitch. You know, I was in meetings and it was through you women that I learned to have some self-worth. It was through you women that I discovered that I wanted to build my self-esteem. That I wanted to be better than what I came in here being. And I got real sick in sobriety, emotionally sick, where I, you know, people were saying, you're crazy. You know, you're absolutely insane, girl. I don't even know how you stay sober through that shit. You know? But I did. Because the healing process took place. You know, I didn't come here and realize I was an alcoholic and just got well. I went through a series of changes, emotional changes, mental changes, physical changes. And one day I looked in the mirror and I thought, is that you, JoJo? It was like, I couldn't believe that was me. You know, the bush came off. Okay, when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I wore blue jeans, boots, and a bebop hat. And I had an afro bush, and it was cut real low in the back. I looked real butchy. And I remember in my first year of sobriety, I had met this man. And I have to share with you, I did not come to Alcoholics Anonymous to find a man. I didn't come to find a woman either, but I did not come looking for a relationship. I came because I knew I was dying. And 6 months after being clean and sober on this program, I met a man in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was lusty after women, so I really was not into men. And he asked me, you know, to take me home. And I just looked at him, who are you talking to? He had nerve enough to call me a lady, and I kept looking around. And wasn't nobody standing there but me. And I thought, is he crazy or what? I didn't know then, but the boy had just come out of a mental institution. I guess anything looked good to him, you know. But I ended up marrying this character, you know. I ended up marrying this character, but before I did that, I remember there was a miracle that took place in the very first year of my sobriety. That was when I discovered I wanted to go to J.J. Newberry's to buy a tube of lipstick because I had this overwhelming feeling that I wanted to be a lady. That I wanted to feel pretty, that I wanted to look pretty, and I wasn't looking pretty, you know, at that point. And I went to J.J. Newberry's to buy a 49-cent tube of lipstick. And a wholesale miracle took place that day in my life. You will never know what it was like for me to walk to that store, to go in that five and dime store, to buy that tube of lipstick that made a radical change in my life, in my lifestyle. 49 cents a tube of lipstick is incredible. You know, I didn't know anything about how to put makeup on, how to do facials, didn't know any of that shit. But I wanted to feel and look pretty. And I went and got that lipstick. Wrong color, but who the hell cares? The day that I got married in Alcoholics Anonymous, I had on a big white wedding dress, a long train, and Cinderella slippers. I went to this big store, and they put all my makeup on. I mean, pretty girl, the girl was pretty. Didn't even look like the same JoJo I knew, you know? And it was nice, you know. It was really nice. If I haven't done anything in Alcoholics Anonymous, I know what it's like to get married and have a wonderful day. You know? I know what it's like. You know, and I said to everybody that day, I said, if I never do anything else in sobriety, this is wonderful. You know? And it was a nice day. And, it was January the 14th of 1978. And, there were over 250 people, maybe 200 people in the audience, and mostly were members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was like, I couldn't even believe that they had came out that day, because maybe you don't remember, but back there, it had rained for about 35 days in Los Angeles. And the cemeteries was rising up, and every damn thing was going on, and people came out in all that rain to see me get married that day, you know. And I couldn't believe all them people. My brother-in-law, he come running back in the dressing room. Well, he said, Jojo, where do you know all them white folks from? I turned around and I said, they're friends of mine. You know, because I had more whites there than I had my own blacks. And that was fine. I didn't have a problem with that. But what was incredible is that all these people had come out. See, I sent Central Office an invitation. They showed up. Central Office made a 12-step call on me that day. Thank you very much. And all of its staff. They were there. It was incredible. I couldn't believe, you know what, I have to tell you how I really felt. I didn't believe that people could love me. Because, see, I grew up not a racist. I've never been a racist. But I grew up prejudiced. And I think the prejudice didn't come from me not liking white people. It came from me not understanding what had went on. And so many negative black input had been put into my life about what went on. I used to sit around and listen to my mom talk about slavery and picking cotton, and my mom was a product of that. And the negatives. I'm not even going to get into it because it ain't necessary. But the negatives. So I grew up not trusting white people is what it was. It was not so much that I didn't like them, because I was one of those defiant kids in my home, and I had a little white boyfriend, you know? And I liked him. He was cute. His family didn't like me, though, because I was black, you know? But I liked him, and I can't even remember his name now. That's how much I liked him. But I think I must have been about 17 years old at that point. And it was new for him, too. He had never dated a black girl. And he discovered I had the same thing that little white girls had. And he said, Jesus, you're not different. You're just better. I said, thank you. But, when I got sober, you know, it was like... See, it wasn't so much that I didn't like you, I felt intimidated. Because if you really want to know the truth, growing up, I wanted to be white. I didn't want to be black. I didn't want to be growing up in poverty. I I had saw how white people lived on the other side of the county, and they had the inside bathroom. I know what it's like to grow up in an outhouse. They had the best of the cars. Their kids were in college. They were real intelligent. They were doctors and lawyers' kids. And I was on the other side of the tracks. The only thing I knew about white folks, and that was white men, that they came over on the black side to be Johns. You know, and I thought, what happened? I mean, why was I born in this family, you know? So there was a lot of deep-seated hatred, but it was even toward my own family. Because all my life I wanted to be someone else. I couldn't understand, out of all of the people in the whole world, why was I born JoJo and why was I born black? You know, it took me a lot of years in sobriety to come to that grips with that. And I didn't realize that day that there would come a time. At 9.5 years sober on this program, it dawned on me. The reason I am who I am and what I represent and what I do, because I am an example. Because I'm the person that has to be in the black ghetto to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because I'm the person that they're going to look at and they're going to see the clear eyes, they're going to say, what do you do? Because I'm the person that's an upstanding citizen in my own neighborhood and they can't figure me out. I go to work every day, I come home. I don't mess with nobody else's shit, but they mess with mine. And that's okay. Because I realize that I've got more than I ever dreamed I would have. You know? I'm the person that every once in a while, one of those drunks on the corner will walk up to me and they will say something like, don't I know you? And I say, yeah, you probably do. Well, do you have a quarter? And I say, well, no, I don't. I said, what do you need a quarter for? Well, I want to buy myself something to eat. I said, well, here, let's go. I'll buy you something to eat. No, no, no. I said, well, then you don't want my quarter. Because what you want is a drink. Or what you want is some drugs. And I'm here to share with you that I used to be just like you. And you have never been like me. And I said, well, I've been just like you. And if you want sobriety, there are certain things that you have to do to go get it. Go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you too can have what I have, because I don't have to beg anything. I'm never going to read. But they're just going to look at and know there's something different about that girl, and I can't quite figure it out. And they get inquisitive, and when they get inquisitive, I'm able to give them the answers. You know, I'm the one in the family that, after all the years of being sober, it took my family 10 years to come around and finally say, I love you. To finally say, I respect you. To finally say, I have a question, maybe you can answer it for me. My kids are on drugs, my kids are this. And I need some help, what can I do? So I stayed sober long enough to watch all of these things happen. At 4 years sober on this program, I talked to my mom on the telephone. My mom said to me, before we hung up, November the 4th of that particular year, 1979, my mom said to me, I think you turned out to be one of the best kids I got, and I love you. I was 28 years old. It was my fourth AA birthday. And I didn't drink 5 minutes before the miracle happened. She was kissing me through the telephone. She didn't cuss me out that morning. And I didn't realize that that was going to be the last time I ever hear my mom's voice. Because my mom died 3 days later. But she validated my life. She gave me what I needed in all those years I had been looking for. She made it okay. That's one of the reasons I didn't drink this year, ladies. Because the obsession to drink came to me this year. After 13 years of being sober on this program, I wanted to get loaded. I salivated at the mouth, and I could swallow and feel the wine in my throat. And my head zoomed back. to my mission in life. That if I drink and I use, I will make my mom's death in vain. I would defeat my purpose in life. And no matter what went on in my life, I wasn't going to be able to drink, and I wasn't going to be able to use. I would have to stay sober. My 13th year was very, very hard for me. You know, I used to look at people when I was 8, 9, and 10 years sober, and they'd talk about the obsessions, and I thought, well, they must not be working the steps. They're not making a lot of meetings. Has nothing to do with that. It tells you in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, there will come a day that you will have no mental effect against that first drink. That defense must come from a power greater than yourself. And all I can tell you is thank God I had a God in my life, because everything fell apart for me this year. Emotionally, I was a damn wreck. My marriage fell apart. We're still together, but it's apart. And see, I had that picture-perfect relationship. You know, everybody used to, oh, Jerome and JoJo. You know, the ideal couple. Picture-perfect relationship, y'all. The goddamn windows got broke. Yeah? Some of them have been replaced, and some of them haven't yet. I asked for a separation. I didn't get it, but I asked for it, and that was something I had never done before. See, I've been in this relationship 13 years, as long as I've been sober. And I don't know what's going to happen to this relationship. My husband said we're going to stay together forever, but that's not how I feel. I just work it a day at a time. Because years ago, when we first got together, 6 months after we were married, we had a big blowout. We had to seek professional help. And I lived with this guy for 6 months and hated his guts. And I'm in the same space that I was in 11 years ago. I don't hate him like I did at that point. I just don't like him, you know. But I love him, you know. But I just don't like him. And what I'm doing is I'm dealing with it a day at a time. You know, and it's hard. It's real hard. I have to ask for a lot of support. My babies became my sponsors this year. My babies are what helped me through this year, because my sponsor died this year. My real beautiful, wonderful, wonderful sponsor. She died July the 3rd. And, this is the first year she's never called me on my birthday and wished me a happy birthday. This is the first year that I just haven't heard her voice. And see, I was real emotionally involved with my sponsor, because nobody else knew all of the shit was going on in my life, but my sponsor knew. She knew. And she never said, JoJo, you ought not do that, you know. She used to say every once in a while, you worry me. You worry me, baby. You know? But I know you're going to be fine, she said. And I tell you, the pain. Sometimes the pain is overwhelming. Sometimes I just don't think I'm going to make it. And I know that. But I'm going to make it. I have a little son that makes things all right when it's all wrong. I adopted this little boy a year or so after we were married. He's 9 years old. And he's the kind of little boy that every mom should have. You know, he'll come up to you and he'll say, I love you, Mommy. I think you're the best mommy in the world. He hasn't done it in a long time, and I miss it. He used to come in there, and his father would be gone, and he'd say, Mom, can I sleep with you tonight? And I'd say, yeah, come on, you know. And he done got so big, he's so independent now, he don't want to sleep with me anymore.
And I missed him throwing his little legs over my body and his, or sleeping all up under me while I have to tell him, get over. You know, I miss that, you know. My son plays the piano, and he's been playing the piano since he was 6 years old, and he's real good at it. And he was rehearsing last night, and he was playing some new music. And he was saying, Mommy, listen to this. You like this? And, you know, it's hard for me to make it through his rehearsals at home, you know, without me having to go into one of the other rooms and say, oh, God, he sound good, you know? Getting through the rehearsals sometimes is really emotional for me, you know. And I think about this little boy and the happiness that he feel, and I'm thinking, I beat myself up because I no longer want to live in that house, and I said to myself, you're going to take the joy out of his life, you're not going to see the gleam in his eye, and all that shit, you know, just running through my head, and I think, God, you got to help me through this, you know. So I ask God to help me through it, and my head says leave, but my guts say no. So I have to follow my guts because that's where my program is, and I have to stay because I, you know, in reality, there's a part of me that don't want to leave. So I'm here, I'm hanging in because it's real tough. I mean, I see perfect relationships in Alcoholics Anonymous, but mine isn't one, and it's okay. It's all right. Alcoholics Anonymous has been real good to me. I mean, it's incredible. I was thinking about Jane and her GED, and the year that my mom died, I graduated and I got my GED. And I went to college. And I'm not I have a lot of black colloquialism in me, and I still talk real country. There's a part of me that's real, real country. You can take the girl out the country, but you can't take the country out the girl. It's there. I mean, I still use the I ain't going, you know, and stuff like that. I use double verbs and double nouns and all that kind of shit, you know, and it's okay. I work for the post office. And I never dreamed that I'd have a job making $30,000 a year, okay? I never thought I would be one of those people. I was an 8th grade dropout, you know? And today I make $30,000 with my job, which is not a whole lot of money, but it's a whole lot of money to me. I mean, it suffices. I've gotten a few things since I've been working at that job. I have a mink coat, and I didn't realize until after I got the coat. I didn't turn into one of those animal people until after I got the coat. Somebody said, sell it. I said, nah. Now that animal is already dead now. I'm not going to chew it with my coat. I'm chew my goddamn coat, you know, I'm sorry they were raised to die, but I'm not true. I like my coat, okay? I like my coat. And I like the diamonds, okay? I love the diamonds. I was telling Mickey when she picked me up from, I almost said picked me up from work today. When she picked me up from the airport, I was telling her I had lost my gold watch on the airplane. Oh, sick. Absolutely sick. Just got it for my AA birthday, okay? And I was on my way to change planes in San Francisco and felt for my watch and realized it wasn't there. And freaked! I said, oh, no! And I only had 30 minutes to catch the other plane. And I ran all the way back over to that other plane and I prayed the whole time. I said, God, please let that watch be there. And I got the little stewardess to take me back on the plane. And I couldn't find the watch. And then the cleaning lady was there, and I said, did you see a gold watch? Oh, yes, here it is. I said, Jesus Christ. I said, lucky, am I lucky? You know, and I got my watch back. I won't even put it on there because the little latches broke. I got to go put a safety, have a safety thing put on it. See, I don't know how it broke or whatever. But I don't know. I do know that I like being sober more than anything in the world. Because it has afforded me some opportunities that I know drunk I would have never been able to do anything like this. To be asked to be a retreat master is like, it's like euphoric. I don't even believe this is happening, you know? I won't say it's organic. I mean, like I'm having an orgasm or anything. But it's nice. It's nice to be. We were talking, I'm going to get ready to shut down, but we were talking over at the cafeteria, and Marguerite says one of her motives for having me come is because I was black. And I think that's wonderful. I think it's absolutely that you would allow me to be a part of you, not because really I'm black, but because I'm different. But because I'm sober. But because I stayed sober long enough to be asked to do something like this. To be asked to be a part of. And you know, everything has happened in my life for a reason. I am one of those people who believe that in every situation, there's a purpose for something to happen. I know when I first went to work for the post office, and I went into this area that was all predominantly white. There was not a black person in sight. They had never had a black person work at this post office. And here come me. So all these people got to adjust. Okay? But what they don't realize is I walked in there with a whole lot of fear. Like, how are they going to treat me? Are they going to like me? And I tell you, I ran into a lot of prejudice. Especially right up there in the little place. I had a little senior citizen's mobile home estate that I became the rural route carrier for. And there were some people that didn't like me. And I think the reason they didn't like me is because I was black. Not for any other reason. They didn't know me, so they definitely couldn't have liked me if they had known me. You know what I'm saying? I was there for a whole year. Not no hello. People were not running out, being overly joyed because I was bringing them their mail. Then something clicked in my head. This is JoJo, you know what? You don't have to let this situation be like this. You can become a part of. Because I would go by and I'd see them peeping out the little shades of the windows. So I decided, I'm going to fix these folks. They're going to either love me or hate me. So you know what I started doing? Stopping my car, getting out my car, going up to their door, knocking on their door, and carrying them their mail. Now, I didn't do that at every house. Because that would be too long. But I got, in a year's time, I probably got around at everybody's house. You know what I'm saying? I would go in and say, hi, my name is JoJo. I'm your mail carrier. I'm here to stay. So let's get acquainted. I want to tell you the miracle that took place. There came a day that I opened up the mailbox and it was like 112 degrees that day. There was a tall glass of lemonade in that mailbox. Ice, I mean, that says, I thought you might want this. Little note that says, I thought you might want this. I've been on that job for 8 years. Everybody know me. There's not a house that I can't go in and not even ask. Just walk on in, open up the refrigerator, get what I want and go. There are people that go to the store out there today who know I drink a lot of mineral water, and they buy mineral water specifically for me. Okay? I come in their house, or they'll have people who have their doors halfway open. That's my signal that it's okay for me to come in. You know, that they're not asleep or whatever. And I get out and I go in and they say, your drink's in the box. And there was this one guy that had a refrigerator on the outside of his door, on the outside. You know, he had like a freezer stuff. One side was mine. He kept it stocked. And he'll say, hey, did you see your Sprite? I said, oh, yeah, his name was Mr. Carruthers. He said, well, whatever you need, just get it. You know. Then one day I looked and he had some beer on my side. I said, hey! Get that shit out of my side of the refrigerator. So they've come to love me. And when people move off of my route, I still get letters and cards. I miss you. I still get Christmas cards with great big smiley faces on it that says, I have never had a mail carrier like you. And I tell you, there were people that was adamant that they were never going to be my friends. God took them away. They're gone. They even died of fleeing. See, I just never dreamed that I would be one of those people that life would turn out the way it is. You know, even though there's a lot of pain, on the flip side, there's a lot of joy. You know, for that I will be forever grateful to you for allowing me to be a part of this weekend. And I hope and pray that we both can grow this weekend together, that I will be able to carry back to L.A. what I really need, because I don't know what it is I really need. I just know that I want to be as teachable as possible this weekend. And I want to be able to carry back all of the love and the support from you women. Because I tell you, I am so sorry that there's just not other people like me in this meeting who could enjoy what it is that I'm enjoying right now. And as I look out over the audience and I look at all of your faces, I don't see any hate. I don't see any prejudice. I see a lot of love. A lot of admiration. And it's not geared toward anybody but me. And I like that. I love being a part of you. And I always say in my pitches, thank you for allowing me to touch your soul. And thank you for allowing you to touch mine. And thank you very much for letting me share.
Well, was I okay?
You were great.